Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Corner Store Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Koval. Glad that you are in the building. Hope you are well and maintaining. Want to encourage you to subscribe on Apple Music and wherever you listen to podcasts to the Corner Store. We had a reconfiguration recently with Apple, so please search the Corner Store and my name and hit subscribe. Please consider rating as well and giving us those 5 stars. Each week, we bring incredible talent, creative minds, and persons into the building. And today, we have a true genius, someone whose debut book is out in the world and really taking the world by storm, an educator, a writer, a dear friend. Felicia Rose Chavez is in the Corner Store. Felicia, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin Cole.
So excited to have you. This has been a long time coming, so thank you for also like being down to, you know, arrange and rearrange. But it is at an appropriate moment because your book is like you're in a moment right now. Like you are, I feel like you're blowing up. You know what I mean?
And I feel like my world has just pivoted a bit. Whereas like there's this alignment of like a life's long mission, and then like an acceptance, a recognition, a momentum about that movement that feels like it's just clicking into place, and it's so exciting.
Yeah, I mean that must, because this, first of all, the book is incredible, and we're going to talk about it. It's the Anti-Racist Writing Workshop, and it is available wherever you find books. Came out through, of course, the good homies, Haymarket Books. It is a breakbeat poetry book, which is interesting because it is, I mean, it has bars. It has so many bars in it, but it's a book of prose. It is kind of like a philosophical treatise, pedagogical perfection meets a memoir of sorts, right? Because you're also telling your own story in there. But yeah, I mean, how long have you been thinking about this project?
I've been living it, you know. It's when I talk about the pedagogy, I talk about how deeply personal it is. It's the life story. It's my life's work as an educator, but also just the moments that we all carry around, you know, as people of color in this world. They just splinter under your skin, and you carry them with you, and you carry them with you until you need to just unburden yourself in whichever way that comes about. You know, for me, that was sitting down on the page and having the courage to just write out these moments in my life that I needed to just release, and I needed to reflect on and sort of, it felt like really empowering for me to look at what I'm doing in the classroom now as like a call and response to all of these years of like educational trauma, all these moments in the classroom that felt wrong, and to say, hey, here's some things that I'm doing so that my students don't experience that. And it's exciting and it's working. And so, yeah, it's something that, you know, I talk about 13 years of educational practice, from teaching, you know, tutoring, kind of door to door in Chicago, my time at Young Chicago Authors thereafter, and then teaching in academia for a long stint. And so it's been there, Kevin. It's been with me in those moments in my heart, and it was time to make something of it.
Yeah.
You know?
No, for sure. Well, yeah, and I so you know, you mentioned all of this lived educational trauma. Like, how far back does it go for you? Like, when, like, how long, like, at what point, like, what do you have a memory of, like, a first time you're like, oh, this does not feel right for me?
Yeah, I joke about, you know, I would hand my husband each chapter, and I would be so scared because I would be kind of revealing something that I felt was private, that maybe we, you know, that I haven't just like laid out on the page before. And I remember handing him a chapter and he just started laughing. He was like, Felicia, because it started with like, oh, this is my, you know, when I think back to third grade, and he's like, come on, you know, like how deep are you going to reach? But it is, I think we feel it. We feel like, I don't like this. Something's not right. You know, my own son comes home and he says, my teacher said this to me today. He was just telling me, out of all the students, his teacher said, Taos, are you sure you're doing your work? And he was like, Mama, is that racial profiling?
Wow.
Wow. He used those words independent of my prompting, but he knew that something was strange about that moment. Yeah. And so I don't know of anybody who's kind of embedded in a white supremacist patriarchy, you know, this educational system in which, you know, you don't feel like you're wrong, like something's wrong. So yeah, it goes way back, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, where you're from New Mexico, Albuquerque.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, tell, like, did you, you know, what was being a student like there? And when did you kind of begin to think of yourself as more than a student and a creator or wanting to be an educator? Like when, you know, what is that trajectory for you?
Sure. I have had, a privileged trajectory. My mom fought for that privilege. So going all the way back to elementary school, she kind of fudged the paperwork a little bit so that I was enrolled in a school where I actually went to preschool. I didn't live in the district. So my elementary school was a predominantly white public school. A lot of those students fed into a private middle and high school in Albuquerque called Albuquerque Academy. And I tested and enrolled into that school.
Can I ask you a question? So even you said predominantly white, like, are you one of a handful, one of the only people of color, or you, like, what's the...
Yeah, these were the quota years, right?
Right.
So you could look around each class, each and every class, and I did, and I counted, and I made sure everyone knew that I was counting. So there were 6 to 7 students of color. This is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, right? So 6 to 7 per class, per year, you know.
Right, but that's traumatic, right? I mean, that is. I mean, yes, you had access to a, you know, a different education system maybe than some of your peers from, you know, your neighborhood, your family, your whatever, but to live through that, even as a young person, if you're cognizant of that differentiation, that itself would seem to be, you know, odd at the least.
I mean, that's the question of privilege, right? So I say I've had this privileged educational background in that I've had access to ready materials. I've had the assumption that I was going to enroll in college. I had the support on campus to kind of pursue that if I wasn't getting that support at home. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is this lived kind of self-hate that you suffer for years, this questioning of not belonging and why, that takes up a lot of psychic space and a lot of emotional energy went into suppressing those feelings on a daily basis. And I, you know, I'm almost 40. I'm just now coming to terms with like my own standard of beauty, my own, you know, sense of womanhood outside of white beauty. And that in and of itself as a young woman is like, oh, that's enough, right? Beyond everything else that you take on. And so, yeah, you know, we've got a sprawling campus, beautiful buildings, teachers with time, and yet there's a lot to process and to, you know, and that comes years later because you're not as savvy then necessarily. You're just trying to survive. But I do remember my senior year. I was just, it happened. It hit me hard. And it took, you know, it took me being 17, 18 to just, I was furious at everyone around me. I was so mad that at the school, at what I had endured, and I was exhausted. And I just, I remember feeling so, so alienated that year.
It was really lonely. That is very sad, but what was kind of ramping up your, what I feel bad for you. But what was the engine for that, for you becoming politicized, I guess? Because that anger, it feels like it's being charged by, or, you know, the battery in your back is from, you know, what you're living through, it seems.
That's a good question. And I think, you know, I haven't ever actually sat and thought about what it was. I always just accepted that maybe that was the culminating moment, that was, you know, that near year naturally lends itself to reflecting back. But I think now that we're talking about it, that perhaps it had something to do with the fact that people are enrolling into college and that they're waving their acceptance letters around and they're not terrified, petrified by the financial burden of it. They're not scared of taking a step that no one in their family had taken before. Like there was just so much that was felt very unique to my situation that I couldn't even reach across and like have someone understand that I wasn't like just super pumped to go to college. Like it was a really complicated, scary thing. And so maybe that played into it as well.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Right. No, I'm sure. I mean, all of these things, right? That's the thing. I mean, that's the thing that's also like, you know, all woven through your book is that, you know, your own experience, which is intersectional AF and, you know, some of the wrestling and untangling of those things. But so at what point then for you, did you start to think about becoming a writer, becoming an educator?
I knew I loved to write. And I initially looked into, I was like, I'm going to be a Supreme Court justice. And that was my vision for myself. Heading off to Wellesley College at 18, I was like, that's what I thought about. But it wasn't until years and years later, working at Young Chicago Authors, and I was in my little like cubicle, and I just had this moment where I was like, okay, I've taught many years now. I've taught writing. I've done it in many forms, right? So obviously this like social justice driven, you know, more political writing, academic writing, some creative writing here and there. I wasn't a creative writing major. I didn't have that focus for myself as an English major in college as an undergraduate. But when I was teaching creative writing class after class, I had a moment where I needed to, once again, and this is a pattern throughout my life, return home to serve as a caretaker. I chose to do this. I shouldn't act like a victim of it. I chose to do this again and again. And I said, well, if I'm going to do that, then I'm going to claim something for my own. And so it's time for me to transition from teaching writing into just doing it myself and making, you know, adopting that practice. And maybe that would serve as a catharsis or a balance to the caretaking that I was offering in my own household in Albuquerque.
Yeah. And what kind of writing was coming out at that time?
It was a lot of reflection about that caretaking.
I'm sure.
So I had returned home at 19 to serve as a caretaker for my mom, who felt like fell into, although that's absolutely not true, it was years in the making, right? But this like deep depression. And so I spent time there. I later returned to help care for my dad, who was suffering in his own way with addiction. And being that resource was incredibly important to me. I deeply, deeply love and appreciate my family. But I didn't know what to do with all of that, all of those experiences that came at like such an early age in my life, you know? So by the time I was like 27, maybe 26, I had an opportunity to write, and that's immediately where my energy went into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of what this book also, you know, charts is your experience in the MFA space. And, you know, part of it, of course, is the difficulty of being in the MFA space in a very traditional MFA program. You know, obviously you would at that point you were, you know, some time into identifying as a writer. You know, those spaces can really, you know, in my, you know, I'm not been trained formally and I'm not been inside of MFA programs, but of course, you know, I have homies and tangentially, but some of what I've seen is that it is that impetus to create is sometimes beaten out of you in those spaces. And then particularly because these spaces remain, you know, white centered, patriarchal, they also, I would imagine then for someone who doesn't fit that billing, these spaces become highly problematic. They become spaces of contestation.
I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. But I think that I was, it again took me a while to pinpoint exactly what that was. I think because I was not entering the space with an ego in terms of my own writing ability. I was relatively new to the craft. And so I accepted my mistreatment as like a reflection of my ability. I understood immediately upon entering the room and seeing my whole, you know, cohort in front of me that I, you know, I received this like Dean's Fellowship and it was for the placeholder for the, you know, a person of color within the program. And it was so hard because I had seen that there was a different way and a better way. I taught in a different way. I'd been part of a community that was the polar opposite of what this was, this traditional approach that felt incredibly toxic and cold and competitive. And I would try to suggest alternatives class by class. Like, what if could we say some nice things about each other's work before we jump in to the critique? Because the critique did not include that. That wasn't part of the discussion, you know?
Right.
And everyone would kind of sigh, like, oh, Felicia, here she is again. We're stuck in workshop with her, you know? And so I would meet in office hours and say, have you considered, right, with the professor? And nothing would come of it. But I would try because I wanted that experience for myself. And finally, I said, you know, you're not going to get that experience for yourself, but you can make it for your undergraduates. And so that's, you know, I taught a variety of nonfiction classes and different workshops. And I just started making it. I was like, okay, you know, you'll be my community now.
And why, I mean, that flip, which, you know, sounds, you know, pretty, it sounds like common sense. But it is not practiced in these spaces. Why is that so important to get that, you know, just that initial cosign or that initial, you know, the feedback that isn't initially critical?
Sure, yeah. You know, I have my own way of going about it, in which we hear what the author actually wants to achieve or accomplish, what the vision is. It's not here yet, but this is where I want to go, right? I think that's an essential element that's missing from the workshop conversation. So if we don't get that, at the very least, let's point to what the author is bringing into the room that's already a success. Let's validate the person's ability, right? Not humor it, not, you know, coddle them or whatever language that people like to use to dismiss this sense of validation, but to recognize that this person is a whole person. This person is a writer. This person has a mission. This person is accomplishing something on the page that's powerful, even if it's not there yet. And I think that's really important for us to hear as writers, is just that we're getting there, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
The audience for this book in your mind before you published it, Who was it? Who did you want to give this book to? Who did you imagine reading it?
It was super practical, actually. I told this story a lot, so I'm sorry if you've heard it before.
No, it's all good.
I took the opportunity to travel. I was a Riley Scholar at Colorado College, and I had a research fund. And so I thought, oh, I'll go to one of these conferences that everybody talks about. I don't do these things, but I'll do it now because it was in Reykjavik, Iceland. And I was like, oh, I want to go. So I joined a panel that's discussing this class that I started when I was at Iowa. In which we shockingly read contemporary writers of color, right? It was a graduate level class for people who were interested in reading writers of color because they weren't getting that in their other classes. So we made it happen, myself and a friend. And so this panel was about that experience of building that class. But I thought as part of my kind of 10 minute panel contribution that I would talk about what I've done since then in terms of my own pedagogy within my own classroom. And it was this 10-minute speech, and I go and I stand up in front of the audience, and I start this speech, but then I just start crying, and I lose it. And I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to stop crying. Because I'm looking around the audience and I see people who have taught me at Iowa. I see people who I went to school with, and this was like implicating that program with, you know, serving them with this emotional and psychological violence that happens years long. And so I get it together and I finish my speech, and folks, they just explode in applause. They pass around a little piece of paper out of someone's purse, and they want they're all getting email addresses from audience members to get a copy of the speech. And I had people talk to me afterward, writers of color who said, I dropped out of my MFA program and here's why, or I ditched it and went for my low res program and here's why. And white educators who were like, I don't want to do that. I don't ever want to do this to someone else. So let's work together. What can we do? And I went right back to Colorado, and I wrote a book proposal and submitted it to Haymarket.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and so now that the book is out, like it seems, you know, I mean, I'm privy to it, you know, in proximity to it, but who is finding this book now? I mean, it's still new in the world very much, but I feel like already, I wonder if you're surprised by the kinds of spaces that it's being used in, talked about, things of this nature.
I want it to be an offering for people who are teachers, people who are students, people who are writers, people who are lifelong learners, people who are in spaces with other people. Like, I see it so broadly, right? It is the anti-racist writing workshop. It is in the context of academia, in the context of higher education. And that's because of its memoir aspect, right? So I was truly writing and reflecting on my own classroom experiences, and I didn't feel like I had the years experience necessary to reflect on my high school teaching, my middle school teaching, my elementary school teaching, all of which I've done, but they're in, you know, small kind of visiting capacity, right? The visiting guest. And so the book itself has a focus, but I think in terms of accessibility, you know, I can't believe the reception, Kevin. It's astounding to me to have like a fifth grader, a fifth grade teacher, just as excited, right, as a director of an MFA program in terms of what they can implement, and to have writers in high school, writers as undergraduates, writers in graduate programs who are telling me, I feel seen, like, thank you, I feel seen, right? There are these like outliers that I don't know what to do with, like Humana Insurance. It's like, let's bring you in and you can talk to our staff. And I'm like, I don't know exactly the bridge,
sure,
that I can build, but everybody tells me there it is. It's there. You just don't see it. Right. But yeah, I am so, so grateful that people can pick up the text and see beyond, you know, the story that I told, and instead gather the tools that I would like to offer.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. I mean, I do think it's elastic and broad, though, in that way, you know, and I think that's part of the reason why people are drawn to it, is that, you know, you might have written it with a specific audience in mind, but that's part of the magic of great writing, is that then it becomes transcendent. And I think it's like, even if you're not into writing at all, right, I think that this is also a, you know, a tale for anyone who is in education, for anyone who's been in education, which means everybody, because it is at its core a memoir, and I think that's the strength. It's like, you know, you're doing a lot of work in this book, but it is your story, and I think that's because you drill down so specific, you know, into that story, it becomes then universal, you know, which is powerful. Typically, right, you are a fairly private person, and, you know, you didn't, for instance, really, if I'm not mistaken, have like a IG account, you know, you weren't really public facing, you know, prior to this. And so now, right, you're doing all these talks and programs and getting all these requests, and there's press, and now you do have an IG and all these public facing things. So how is this feeling for you? Like you stepped into the spotlight.
Yeah, it's
and you're doing great, by the way.
So, thank you. Yeah. It's very, very hard for me, and it's scary to like gear up. I get so nervous for these sorts of talks. Like, I just did that Kais and Lehman talk.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Yeah.
And thank you. I was sitting in the, what they call the little green room, the Zoom green, the Skype green room, whatever. And I didn't say a word to him. This poor man has like taken time to be with me, but I couldn't even talk to him, like not even small talk, because I was so petrified that we were just about to talk. So yeah, it's, I'm a work in progress.
No, first of all, that's very funny. But are you, I mean, do you, you know, obviously through the practice, through the process, I mean, this is a book that will have legs. I mean, is already being incorporated into people's curriculum. You know, this is, I mean, we're obviously in shelter, but I also could imagine, you know, people are going to want to have you come run around with it, which is exciting for a fan of the book. Is that exciting for you, that prospect of, you know, getting asked to do more and more because of what you've shared with the world?
I mean, the facilitations are the hard work, right? That I'm down for any day of the week. So, you know, I've got a workshop of menus, and it really excites me to talk to teachers. It excites me even more to talk to the students, because I'm like, here's what you demand. Like, you know, here's what you have the power to ask for, and they don't even know it, right? And so those opportunities, they motivate me to continue with all this, weary social media. Try so hard, Kevin. Yeah.
Well, what has been so far, and again, like, this is the, you know, the life of the book is we're still in its infancy. But what has been the most surprising and the most pleasing moments for you thus far in the life of having the book in the world?
You ask such great questions. Thanks. You ask questions that I've not been asked yet.
Well, that's good.
I really appreciate it. Thank God. Yeah, you're good.
Thanks.
I think you said the most surprising and the most pleasing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the most surprising for me has been, you know, the what I can only, you know, come to mind is a slanderous attack, the character attack by a family member.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
That made me so mad.
And that's why I'm using the word privilege now, because he uses it.
Yeah.
And kind of flings it around and kind of manipulates that term.
Absolutely.
And so I thought, well, I'd own it, right? But then address how complicated that is and how I am the outcome of my education in so many ways, right? Because I am had access to feel to these educational systems, to feel emboldened to speak up, right? And to work against the traditions that of silencing, I am able then to gift back to these institutions feedback. Right? Here's how we can all get better. There's an improved way to approach it. So anyway, I have a white male cousin, husband of a cousin, cousin-in-law.
I knew he was an in-law when I read that. I knew he was, he felt on some like MAGA in-law married in type of, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, if you couldn't guess by like, if you understand Hispanic tradition, you know, I mean, it was bad.
I reported the comment. Yes.
It's wild. It sent me in a tailspin because I all along have been preparing. Okay, you know, you're going to get the attack. And I get it. I get it all the time. And it's fast. It's always like the first comment that I'll get if I'll post something on social media. It's always some little like, racism doesn't exist, you know? And it's so quick that it's like, whoa, where did that, like someone's waiting to just type that in, you know, again and again. Or I've never experienced anything like this. So there's, you know, can't possibly be true, which is just all more evidence of why we need to adopt the book and adopt a new practice. Not to say that people aren't out there doing this work. And I want to acknowledge that every single time. This is just picking up on where other people have been doing this work for years. So I need to say that. But yeah, anyway, so we have this cousin-in-law who comes out and speaks out against me. He says I'm disgusting and the work disgusts him, and that I'm shaming my family. And so that was incredibly painful for me because it was so unexpected. But I think he gave me the opportunity to experience ugliness early on, which in a way is a gift. But also to experience the folks who rallied around me immediately afterward, you know, who wrote reviews of the book, having been early readers and gave their own opinions. And so that felt really good to receive the love of my other family members and the love of the writing community and the educational community.
Yeah.
In terms of the most surprising, you know, when the book finished, when I turned in the manuscript, I wrote letters to authors who I wanted to pay homage to. Like, I wanted to thank them for the work that they'd been doing for so long. And Kevin, I tried to do that as well every time I talk about the book. I tried to mention you because you're one of the writers who's championed this, who's done this work, who's championed me, but so many others to exercise that authentic voice that, you know, to go beyond the lie of their own education and really believe in themselves. So, thank you.
Oh, of course.
I reached out with these letters, right? And those, it was just such an exciting practice for me to take that on. And now I get to receive letters, which I'm in tears. Like, there was a really bad week where everyone was sick and things were terrible in here. And I wasn't sure, like, sometimes whether I was crying because I was, like, in despair over the household. And that's usually the case when you have two small children. But also, like, incredibly moved and touched and so proud when I get these letters from people. I thank God, like, I wrote a book and writers are writing me these gorgeous pieces of art, thanking me, and educators, you know, across the spectrum, That is a surprise. I was not anticipating the kind of like reciprocal nature of the letter writing and the love letter writing. And so that, it's been so, so special for me.
That's good. That's beautiful. Well, the book is so important, and the work is, you know, it has legs, and I'm so glad to see it doing its thing in the world. It's very, very exciting. The book, of course, is the Anti-Racist Writing Workshop. It's available everywhere, and you can get it directly from Haymarket Books. Felicia Rose Chavez, where can people now find you on the internets and stay in tune with all of what you are doing?
Well, I have a website that I made myself, antiracistworkshop.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Write Anti-Racist on Twitter, and Felicia Rose Chavez everywhere else. So reach out. I'd love to hear from everybody.
Thank you so much for being in the Corner Store. It's been a pleasure
talking
to you.
Thank you, Kevin. Lovely. Yes.
Shout out our super producer, DJ Cashera. Big up boss man, Todd Manley. Thank you to our official Corner Store photog, Mercedes Zapata. Salutes to the Snack Door, Max. Also, please, y'all, follow our Instagram. It's corner_pod on IG, on Twitter. Tell us who you want to see in the Corner Store. And also, please consider dropping a couple of dollars into our Patreon account. It's patreon.com/cornerstore_pod.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.